The fluorescent lights hummed loudly.
This is where I asked them to put my office, Martine thought.
Although public relations coordinator was technically not a Guardia post, Martine's job required access to powerful computers and a tech-savvy staff. Thus, the Division of Electronic Security had seemed a far more logical home for her than an under-equipped office upstairs.
Tonight, Martine thought, I will need every bit of technology available.
For the past few months, her primary focus had been to help the palace stay on message during the gradual transfer of power to Prince Julian. It had not been easy. The transition between leaders had provided an opportunity for protesters to speak out against the monarchy. According to the Spanish Constitution, the monarchy stood as a symbol of Spain's enduring unity and permanence. But Martín knew there had been nothing unified about Spain for some time now. In 1931, the Second Republic had marked the end of the monarchy, and then the putsch of General Franco in 1936 had plunged the country into civil war. Today, although the reinstated monarchy was considered a liberal democracy, many liberals continued to denounce the king as an outdated vestige of an oppressive religio-military past, as well as a daily reminder that Spain still had a way to go before it could fully join the modern world. Mónica Martín's messaging this month had included the usual portrayals of the king as a beloved symbol who held no real power. Of course, it was a tough sell when the sovereign was commander-in-chief of the armed forces as well as head of state.
Head of state, Martín mused, in a country where separation between church and state has always been controversial.
The ailing king's close relationship with Bishop Valdespino had been a thorn in the side of secularists and liberals for many years.
And then there is Prince Julian, she thought.
Martine knew she owed her job to the prince, but he certainly had been making that job more difficult recently. A few weeks ago, the prince had made the worst PR blunder Martine had ever witnessed. On national television, Prince Julian had gotten down on his knees and made a ludicrous proposal to Umbra Vidal. The excruciating moment could not have been any more awkward unless Umbra had declined to marry him, which, fortunately, she had the good sense not to do. Unfortunately, in the aftermath, Umbra Vidal had revealed herself to be more of a handful than Julian had anticipated, and the fallout from her extracurricular behavior this month had become one of Martine's primary PR concerns. Tonight, however, Umbra's indiscretions seemed all but forgotten. The tidal wave of media activity generated by the events in Bilbao had swelled to an unprecedented magnitude. In the past hour, a viral proliferation of conspiracy theories had taken the world by storm, including several new hypotheses involving Bishop Valdespino. The most significant development concerned the Guggenheim assassin, who had been given access to Kirsch's event on orders of someone inside the royal palace. This damning bit of news had unleashed a deluge of conspiracy theories accusing the bedridden king and Bishop Valdespino of conspiring to murder Edmund Kirsch, a virtual demigod in the digital world and a beloved American hero who had chosen to live in Spain.
This is going to destroy Valdespino, Martine thought.
Everyone listen up, Garza now shouted as he strode into the control room. Prince Julian and Bishop Valdespino are together somewhere on the premises. Check all security feeds and find them, now.
The commander stalked into Martine's office and quietly updated her on the situation with the prince and the bishop.
Gone? She said, incredulous. And they left their phones in the prince's safe?
Garza shrugged.
Apparently so we can't track them.
Well, we'd better find them, Martine declared.
Prince Julian needs to make a statement right now, and he needs to distance himself from Valdespino as much as possible.
She relayed all the latest developments. Now it was Garza's turn to look incredulous.
It's all hearsay. There's no way Valdespino could be behind an assassination. Maybe not, but the killing seems to be tied to the Catholic Church. Someone just found a direct connection between the shooter and a highly placed church official. Have a look.
Martine pulled up the latest Conspiracy Net update, which was, once again, credited to the whistleblower called monte@iglesia.org.
This went live a few minutes ago.
Garza crouched down and began reading the update.
The Pope, he protested. Avila has a personal connection with... Keep reading.
When Garza finished, he stepped back from the screen and blinked his eyes repeatedly, as if trying to wake himself from a bad dream. At that moment, a male voice called from the control room.
Commander Garza, I've located them.
Garza and Martine hurried over to the cubicle of Agent Suresh Bala, an Indian-born surveillance specialist who pointed to the security feed on his monitor on which two forms were visible, one in flowing bishop's robes and the other in a formal suit. They appeared to be walking on a wooded path.
East Garden, Suresh said, 2 minutes ago.
They've exited the building?
Garza demanded.
Hold on, sir.
Suresh fast-forwarded the footage, managing to follow the bishop and the prince on various cameras located at intervals across the palace complex as the two men left the garden and moved through an enclosed courtyard.
Where are they going?
Martine had a good idea where they were going, and she noted that Valdespino had taken a shrewd, circuitous route that kept them out of sight of the media trucks on the main plaza. As she anticipated, Valdespino and Julian arrived at the southern service entrance of Almudena Cathedral, where the bishop unlocked the door and ushered Prince Julian inside. The door swung shut, and the two men were gone. Garza stared mutely at the screen, clearly struggling to make sense of what he had just seen.
Keep me posted, he finally said,
and motioned Martine aside. Once they were out of earshot, Garza whispered,
I have no idea how Bishop Valdespino persuaded Prince Julian to follow him out of the palace, or to leave his phone behind, but clearly the prince has no idea about these accusations against Valdespino, or he would know to distance himself.
I agree, Martine said, and I'd hate to speculate as to what the bishop's endgame might be, but...
She stopped.
But what?
Garza demanded. Martine sighed.
It appears Valdespino may have just taken an extremely valuable hostage.
Some 250 miles to the north, inside the atrium of the Guggenheim Museum, Agent Fonseca's phone began buzzing. It was the sixth time in 20 minutes. When he glanced down at the caller ID, he felt his body snap to attention.
See?
He answered, his heart pounding. The voice on the line spoke in Spanish, slowly and deliberately.
Agent Fonseca, as you are well aware, Spain's future queen consort has made some terrible missteps this evening, associating herself with the wrong people and causing significant embarrassment to the royal palace. In order that no further damage be done, it is crucial that you get her back to the palace as quickly as possible.
I'm afraid Ms. Vidal's location is unknown at the moment.
40 minutes ago, Edmund Kirsch's jet took off from Bilbao Airport, headed for Barcelona, the voice asserted. I believe Ms. Vidal was on that plane.
How would you know that?
Fonseca blurted, and then instantly regretted his impertinent tone.
If you were doing your job, the voice replied sharply, you would know too. I want you and your partner to pursue her at once. A military transport is fueling at Bilbao Airport for you right now.
If Miss Vidal is on that jet, Fonseca said,
She is probably traveling with the American Professor Robert Langdon.
Yes, the caller said angrily. I have no idea how this man persuaded Ms. Vidal to abandon her security and run off with him, but Mr. Langdon is clearly a liability. Your mission is to find Ms. Vidal and bring her back by force if necessary.
And if Langdon interferes?
There was a heavy silence.
Do your best to limit collateral damage, the caller replied. But this crisis is severe enough that Professor Langdon would be an acceptable casualty.
Chapter 46 ConspiracyNet.com Breaking News. Kirsch coverage goes mainstream. Edmund Kirsch's scientific announcement tonight began as an online presentation that attracted a staggering 3 million online viewers. In the wake of his assassination, however, the Kirsch story is now being covered on mainstream networks live around the world, with current viewership estimated at over 80 million. Chapter 47 As Kirsch's Gulfstream G550 began its descent into Barcelona, Robert Langdon drained his second mug of coffee and gazed down at the remains of the impromptu late-night snack that he and Ambra had just shared from Edmund's galley. Nuts, rice cakes, and assorted vegan bars that all tasted the same to him. Across the table, Ambra had just finished her second glass of red wine and was looking much more relaxed.
"Thanks for listening," she said, sounding sheepish. "Obviously I haven't been able to talk about Julian with anyone."
Langdon gave her an understanding nod, having just heard the story of Julian's awkward proposal to her on television. "She didn't have a choice," Langdon agreed, knowing full well that Ambra could not risk shaming the future king of Spain on national television.
"Obviously, if I'd known he was going to propose so quickly," Ambra said, "I would have told him I can't have children, but it all happened without warning."
She shook her head and looked sadly out the window.
"I thought I liked him. I don't know. Maybe it was just the thrill of..."
"A tall, dark, handsome prince?" Langdon ventured with a lopsided grin. Ambra laughed quietly and turned back to him.
"He did have that going for him. I don't know, he seemed like a good man. Sheltered, maybe, but a romantic. Not the kind of man who would ever be involved in killing Edmund."
Langdon suspected she was right. The prince had little to gain from Edmund's death, and there was no solid evidence to suggest that the prince was involved in any way. Only a phone call from someone inside the palace asking to add Admiral Avila to the guest list. At this point, Bishop Valdespino seemed to be the most obvious suspect, having been privy to Edmund's announcement early enough to formulate a plan to stop it, and also knowing better than anyone just how destructive it might be to the authority of the world's religions.
"Obviously I can't marry Julian," Ambra said quietly. "I keep thinking he'll break off the engagement, now that he knows I can't have children. His bloodline has held the crown for most of the last 4 centuries. Something tells me that a museum administrator from Bilbao will not be the reason the lineage ends."
The speaker overhead crackled, and the pilots announced that it was time to prepare for their landing in Barcelona. Jarred from her ruminations about the prince, Ambra stood and began tidying up the cabin, rinsing their glasses in the galley, and disposing of the uneaten food. "Professor," Winston chimed from Edmund's phone on the table, "I thought you should be aware that there is new information now going viral online. Strong evidence suggesting a secret link between Bishop Valdespino and the assassin Admiral Avila." Langdon was alarmed by the news. "Unfortunately, there is more," Winston added.
As you know, Kirsch's secret meeting with Bishop Val d'Espino included two other religious leaders, a prominent rabbi and a well-loved imam. Last night, the imam was found dead in the desert near Dubai, and, in the last few minutes, there is troubling news coming out of Budapest. It seems the rabbi has been found dead of an apparent heart attack.
Langdon was stunned.
Bloggers, Winston said, are already questioning the coincidental timing of their deaths.
Langdon nodded in mute disbelief. One way or the other, Bishop Antonio Val d'Espino was now the only living person on Earth who knew what Kirsch had discovered. When the Gulfstream G550 touched down onto the lone runway at Sabadell Airport in the foothills of Barcelona, Ambra was relieved to see no signs of waiting paparazzi or press. According to Edmund, in order to avoid dealing with starstruck fans at Barcelona's El Prat Airport, he chose to keep his plane at this small jetport. That was not the real reason, Ambra knew. In reality, Edmund loved attention, and admitted to keeping his plane at Sabadell only to have an excuse to drive the winding roads to his home in his favorite sports car, a Tesla Model X P90D that Elon Musk had allegedly hand-delivered to him as a gift. Supposedly, Edmund had once challenged his jet pilots to a 1 mile drag race on the runway, Gulfstream versus Tesla. But his pilots had done the math and declined.
I'll miss Edmund, Ambra thought ruefully.
Yes, he was self-indulgent and brash, but his brilliant imagination deserved so much more from life than what happened to him tonight.
I just hope we can honor him by unveiling his discovery.
When the plane arrived inside Edmund's single-plane hangar and powered down, Ambra could see that everything here was quiet. Apparently, she and Professor Langdon were still flying under the radar. As she led the way down the jet's staircase, Ambra breathed deeply, trying to clear her head. The second glass of wine had taken hold, and she regretted drinking it. Stepping down onto the cement floor of the hangar, she faltered slightly and felt Langdon's strong hand on her shoulder, steadying her.
Thanks, she whispered, smiling back at the professor, whose two cups of coffee had left him looking wide awake and wired.
We should get out of sight as quickly as possible, Langdon said, eyeing the sleek black SUV parked in the corner. I assume that's the vehicle you told me about?
She nodded. Edmund's secret love.
Odd license plate. Ambra eyed the car's vanity plate and chuckled. E-Wave.
Well, she explained, Edmund told me that Google and NASA recently acquired a groundbreaking supercomputer called D-Wave, one of the world's first quantum computers. He tried to explain it to me, but it was pretty complicated. Something about superpositions and quantum mechanics and creating an entirely new breed of machine. Anyhow, Edmund said he wanted to build something that would blow D-Wave out of the water. He planned to call his new computer E-Wave.
E for Edmund, Langdon mused.
And E is one step beyond D, Ambra thought, recalling Edmund's story about the famous computer in 2001 A Space Odyssey, which, according to urban legend, had been named HAL because each letter occurred alphabetically one letter ahead of IBM.
And the car key? Langdon asked. You said you know where he hides it?
He doesn't use a key.
Ambra held up Edmund's phone.
He showed me this when we came here last month.
She touched the phone screen, launched the Tesla app, and selected the summon command. Instantly, in the corner of the hangar, the SUV's headlights blazed to life, and the Tesla, without the slightest sound, slid smoothly up beside them and stopped. Langdon cocked his head, looking unnerved by the prospect of a car that drove itself.
"Don't worry,"
Ambra assured him. "I'll let you drive to Edmund's apartment." Langdon nodded his agreement and began circling around to the driver's side. As he passed the front of the car, he paused, staring down at the license plate and laughing out loud. Ambra knew exactly what had amused him. Edmund's license plate frame, "And the geek shall inherit the earth." "Only Edmund," Langdon said as he climbed in behind the wheel. "Subtlety was never his forte."
"He loved this car,"
Ambra said, getting in next to Langdon.
"Fully electric and faster than a Ferrari."
Langdon shrugged, eyeing the high-tech dashboard. "I'm not really a car guy." Ambra smiled.
"You will be."
Chapter 48. As Abila's Uber raced eastward through the darkness, the Admiral wondered how many times during his years as a naval officer he had made port in Barcelona. His previous life seemed a world away now, having ended in a fiery flash in Seville. Fate was a cruel and unpredictable mistress, and yet there seemed an eerie equilibrium about her now. The same fate that had torn out his soul in the Cathedral of Seville had now granted him a second life, a fresh start born within the sanctuary walls of a very different cathedral. Ironically, the person who had taken him there was a simple physical therapist named Marco.
"A meeting with the Pope?"
Avila had asked his trainer months ago, when Marco first proposed the idea.
"Tomorrow? In Rome?"
"Tomorrow in Spain," Marco had replied. "The Pope is here." Avila eyed him as if he were crazy.
"The media have said nothing about His Holiness being in Spain."
"A little trust, Admiral," Marco replied with a laugh. "Unless you've got somewhere else to be tomorrow."
Avila glanced down at his injured leg.
"We'll leave at 9, Marco prompted. "I promise our little trip will be far less painful than rehab."
The next morning, Avila got dressed in a navy uniform that Marco had retrieved from Avila's home, grabbed a pair of crutches, and hobbled out to Marco's car, an old Fiat. Marco drove out of the hospital lot and headed south on Avenida de la Raza, eventually leaving the city and getting on Highway N4, heading south.
"Where are we going?"
Avila asked, suddenly uneasy.
"Relax," Marco said, smiling. "Just trust me. It'll only take half an hour."
Avila knew there was nothing but parched pasture land on the N4 for at least another 150 kilometers. He was beginning to think he had made a terrible mistake. Half an hour into the journey, they approached the eerie ghost town of El Torbiscal, a once prosperous farming village whose population had recently dwindled to zero.
"Where in the world is he taking me?"
Marco drove on for several minutes, then exited the highway and turned north.
"Can you see it?"
Marco asked, pointing into the distance across a fallow field. Avila saw nothing. Either the young trainer was hallucinating or Avila's eyes were getting old.
"Isn't it amazing?"
Marco declared. Avila squinted into the sun and finally saw a dark form rising out of the landscape. As they drew closer, his eyes widened in disbelief.
"Is that a cathedral?"
The scale of the building looked like something he might expect to see in Madrid or Paris. Avila had lived in Seville his entire life, but had never known of a cathedral out here in the middle of nowhere. The closer they drove, the more impressive the complex appeared, its massive cement walls providing a level of security that Avila had seen only in Vatican City. Marco left the main highway and drove along a short access road toward the cathedral, approaching a towering iron gate that blocked their way. As they came to a stop, Marco pulled a laminated card from the glove box and placed it on the dashboard. A security guard approached, eyed the card, and then peered into the vehicle, smiling broadly when he saw Marco.
Bienvenidos, the guard said. ¿Qué tal, Marco?
The two men shook hands, and Marco introduced Admiral Avila.
Ha venido a conocer al Papa,
Marco told the guard. He's come to meet the Pope. The guard nodded, admiring the medals on Avila's uniform, and waved them on. As the huge gate swung open, Avila felt like he was entering a medieval castle. The soaring Gothic cathedral that appeared before them had 8 towering spires, each with a triple-tiered bell tower. A trio of massive cupolas made up the body of the structure, the exterior of which was composed of dark brown and white stone, giving it an unusually modern feel. Avila lowered his gaze to the access road, which forked into 3 parallel roadways, each lined with a phalanx of tall palm trees. To his surprise, the entire area was jammed with parked vehicles. Hundreds of them. Luxury sedans, dilapidated buses, mud-covered mopeds, everything imaginable. Marco bypassed them all, driving straight to the church's front courtyard, where a security guard saw them, checked his watch, and waved them into an empty parking spot that had clearly been reserved for them.
We're a little late, Marco said. We should hurry inside.
Avila was about to reply, but the words were lodged in his throat. He had just seen the sign in front of the church. Iglesia Católica Palmariana. My God. Avila felt himself recoil. I've heard of this church. He turned to Marco, trying to control his pounding heart.
This is your church, Marco?
Avila tried not to sound alarmed.
You're a Palmarian?
Marco smiled. You say the word like it's some kind of disease. I'm just a devout Catholic who believes that Rome has gone astray. Avila raised his eyes again to the church. Marco's strange claim about knowing the Pope suddenly made sense. The Pope is here in Spain. A few years ago, the television network Canal Sur had aired a documentary titled La Iglesia Oscura, whose purpose was to unveil some of the secrets of the Palmarian Church. Avila had been stunned to learn of the strange church's existence, not to mention its growing congregation and influence. According to lore, the Palmarian Church had been founded after some local residents claimed to have witnessed a series of mystical visions in a field nearby. Allegedly, the Virgin Mary had appeared to them and warned that the Catholic Church was rife with the heresy of modernism, and that the true faith needed to be protected. The Virgin Mary had urged the Palmarians to establish an alternative church and denounce the current pope in Rome as a false pope. This conviction that the Vatican's pope was not the valid pontiff was known as sedevacantism, a belief that St. Peter's seat was literally vacant. Furthermore, the Palmarians claimed to have evidence that the true pope was in fact their own founder, a man named Clemente Dominguez y Gómez, who took the name Pope Gregory the 17th. Under Pope Gregory, the anti-pope in the view of mainstream Catholics, the Palmarian Church grew steadily. In 2005, when Pope Gregory died while presiding over an Easter Mass, his supporters hailed the timing of his death as a miraculous sign from above, confirming that this man was in fact connected directly to God. Now, as Avila gazed up at the massive church, he couldn't help but view the building as sinister. Whoever the current anti-pope might be, I have no interest in meeting him. In addition to criticism over their bold claims about the papacy, the Palmerian Church endured allegations of brainwashing, cult-like intimidation, and even responsibility for several mysterious deaths, including that of church member Bridget Crosby, who, according to her family's attorneys, had been unable to escape one of the Palmerian churches in Ireland. Avila didn't want to be rude to his new friend, but this was not at all what he had expected from today's trip.
"Marco," he said with an apologetic sigh, "I'm sorry, but I don't think I can do this."
"I had a feeling you were going to say that," Marco replied, seemingly unfazed. "And I admit, I had the same reaction when I first came here. I too had heard all the gossip and dark rumors. But I can assure you, it's nothing more than a smear campaign led by the Vatican."
"Can you blame them?"
Avila wondered. "Your church declared them illegitimate."
"Rome needed a reason to excommunicate us, so they made up lies. For years, the Vatican has been spreading disinformation about the Palmerians."
Avila assessed the magnificent cathedral in the middle of nowhere. Something about it felt strange to him.
"I'm confused," he said. "If you have no ties to the Vatican, where does all your money come from?"
Marco smiled.
"You would be amazed at the number of secret followers the Palmerians have within the Catholic clergy. There are many conservative Catholic parishes here in Spain that do not approve of the liberal changes emanating from Rome, and they are quietly funneling money to churches like ours, where traditional values are upheld."
The answer was unexpected, but it rang true for Avila. He, too, had sensed a growing schism within the Catholic Church, a rift between those who believed the Church needed to modernize or die, and those who believed the Church's true purpose was to remain steadfast in the face of an evolving world.
"The current Pope is a remarkable man," Marco said. "I told him your story, and he said he would be honored to welcome a decorated military officer to our church and meet with you personally after the service today. Like his predecessors, he had a military background before finding God, and he understands what you're going through. I really think his viewpoint might help you find peace."
Marco opened his door to get out of the car, but Avila could not move. He just sat in place, staring up at the massive structure, feeling guilty for harboring a blind prejudice against these people. To be fair, he knew nothing of the Palmerian Church except the rumors, and it was not as if the Vatican were without scandal. Moreover, Avila's own church had not helped him at all after the attack. "Forgive your enemies," the nun had told him. "Turn the other cheek."
"Luis, listen to me," Marco whispered. "I realize I tricked you a bit into coming here, but it was with good intentions. I wanted you to meet this man. His ideas have changed my life dramatically. After I lost my leg, I was in the place where you are now. I wanted to die. I was sinking into darkness. And this man's words gave me a purpose. Just come and hear him preach."
Avila hesitated. "I'm happy for you, Marco, but I think I'll be fine on my own."
"Fine?" the young man laughed. "A week ago, you put a gun to your head and pulled the trigger. You are not fine, my friend."
"He's right," Avila knew. "And 1 week from now, when my therapy is done, I will be back home, alone, and adrift again."
"What are you afraid of?" Marco pressed. "You're a naval officer, a grown man who commanded a ship. Are you afraid the Pope is going to brainwash you in 10 minutes and take you hostage?"
"I'm not sure what I'm afraid of," Avila thought, staring down at his injured leg, feeling strangely small and impotent. For most of his life he had been the one in charge, the one giving orders. He was uncertain about the prospect of taking orders from someone else.
Never mind, Marco finally said, refastening his seatbelt. I'm sorry. I can see you're uncomfortable. I didn't mean to pressure you.
He reached down to start the car. Avila felt like a fool. Marco was practically a child, one-third Avila's age, missing a leg, trying to help out a fellow invalid, and Avila had thanked him by being ungrateful, skeptical, and condescending.
No, Avila said. Forgive me, Marco. I'd be honored to listen to the man preach.
Chapter 49. The windshield on Edmund's Tesla Model X was expansive, morphing seamlessly into the car's roof somewhere behind Langdon's head, giving him the disorienting sense he was floating inside a glass bubble. Guiding the car along the wooded highway north of Barcelona, Langdon was surprised to find himself driving well in excess of the roadway's generous 120 km/h speed limit. The vehicle's silent electric engine and linear acceleration seemed to make every speed feel nearly identical. In the seat beside him, Ambra was busy browsing the internet on the car's massive dashboard computer display, relaying to Langdon the news that was now breaking worldwide. An ever-deepening web of intrigue was emerging, including rumors that Bishop Valdespino had been wiring funds to the anti-pope of the Palmerian Church, who allegedly had military ties with conservative Carlists and appeared to be responsible not only for Edmund's death, but also for the deaths of Syed al-Fadl and Rabbi Yehuda Kirvish. As Ambra read aloud, it became clear that media outlets everywhere were now asking the same question. What could Edmund Kirsch possibly have discovered that was so threatening that a prominent bishop and a conservative Catholic sect would murder him in an effort to silence his announcement?
The viewership numbers are incredible, Ambra said, glancing up from the screen. Public interest in this story is unprecedented. It seems like the entire world is transfixed.
In that instant, Langdon realized that perhaps there was a macabre silver lining to Edmund's horrific murder. With all the media attention, Kirsch's global audience had grown far larger than he could ever have imagined. Right now, even in death, Edmund held the world's ear. The realization made Langdon even more committed to achieving his goal, to find Edmund's 47-letter password and launch his presentation to the world.
There's no statement yet from Julian, Ambra said, sounding puzzled. Not a single word from the royal palace. It makes no sense. I've had personal experience with their PR coordinator, Monica Martin, and she's all about transparency and sharing information before the press can twist it. I'm sure she's urging Julian to make a statement.
Langdon suspected she was right, considering the media was accusing the palace's primary religious advisor of conspiracy, possibly even murder. It seemed logical that Julian should make a statement of some sort, even if only to say that the palace was investigating the accusations. Especially, Langdon added, if you consider that the country's future queen consort was standing right beside Edmund when he was shot. It could have been you, Ambra. The prince should at least say he's relieved that you're safe.
I'm not sure he is, she said matter-of-factly, turning off the browser and leaning back in her seat.
Langdon glanced over. Well, for whatever it's worth, I'm glad you're safe. I'm not sure I could have handled tonight all alone.
Alone? An accented voice demanded through the car's speakers. How quickly we forget.
Langdon laughed at Winston's indignant outburst. Winston, did Edmund really program you to be defensive and insecure?
No, Winston said. He programmed me to observe, learn, and
mimic human behavior. My tone was more an attempt at humor, which Edmund encouraged me to develop. Humor cannot be programmed. It must be learned.
Well, you're learning well.
Am I? Winston entreated. Perhaps you could say that again.
Langdon laughed out loud. As I said, you're learning well.
Umbra had now returned the dashboard display to its default page, a navigation program consisting of a satellite photo on which a tiny avatar of their car was visible. Langdon could see that they had wound through the Coyserola Mountains and were now merging onto Highway B-20 toward Barcelona. To the south of their location, on the satellite photo, Langdon spotted something unusual that drew his attention. A large forested area in the middle of the urban sprawl. The green expanse was elongated and amorphous, like a giant amoeba.
"Is that Park Güell?" he asked.
Umbra glanced at the screen and nodded.
"Good eye."
"Edmund stopped there frequently," Winston added, "on his way home from the airport." Langdon was not surprised. Park Güell was one of the best-known masterpieces of Antoni Gaudí, the same architect and artist whose work Edmund displayed on his phone case. Gaudí was a lot like Edmund, Langdon thought, a groundbreaking visionary for whom the normal rules did not apply. A devout student of nature, Antoni Gaudí had taken his architectural inspiration from organic forms, using God's natural world to help him design fluid, biomorphic structures that often appeared to have grown out of the ground themselves. "There are no straight lines in nature," Gaudí was once quoted as saying, and indeed there were very few straight lines in his work either. Often described as the progenitor of living architecture and biological design, Gaudí invented never-before-seen techniques of carpentry, ironwork, glasswork, and ceramics in order to sheathe his buildings in dazzling, colorful skins. Even now, nearly a century after Gaudí's death, tourists from around the world traveled to Barcelona to get a glimpse of his inimitable modernist style. His works included parks, public buildings, private mansions, and, of course, his magnum opus, Sagrada Familia, the massive Catholic basilica whose skyscraping sea-sponge spires dominated Barcelona's skyline and which critics hailed as being unlike anything in the entire history of art. Langdon had always marveled at Gaudí's audacious vision for Sagrada Familia, a basilica so colossal that it remained under construction today, nearly 140 years after its groundbreaking. Tonight, as Langdon eyed the car's satellite image of Gaudí's famous Park Güell, he recalled his first visit to the park as a college student, a stroll through a fantasy land of twisting tree-like columns supporting elevated walkways, nebulous, misshapen benches, grottos with fountains resembling dragons and fish, and an undulating white wall so distinctively fluid that it looked like the whipping flagellum of a giant, single-celled creature. "Edmund loved everything Gaudí," Winston continued, "in particular his concept of nature as organic art." Langdon's mind touched again on Edmund's discovery. Nature, organics, the creation. He flashed on Gaudí's famous Barcelona penates, hexagonal paving tiles commissioned for the sidewalks of the city. Each tile bore an identical swirling design of seemingly meaningless squiggles, and yet when they were all arranged and rotated as intended, a startling pattern emerged, an underwater seascape that gave the impression of plankton, microbes, and undersea flora. La sopa primordial, as the locals often called the design. Gaudí's primordial soup, Langdon thought, again startled by how perfectly the city of Barcelona dovetailed with Edmund's curiosity
about the beginnings of life. The prevailing scientific theory was that life had begun in the Earth's primordial soup, those early oceans where volcanoes spewed rich chemicals which swirled around one another, constantly bombarded by lightning bolts from endless storms, until suddenly, like some kind of microscopic golem, the first single-celled creature sprang to life. Umbra, Langdon said, you're a museum curator. You must have discussed art frequently with Edmund. Did he ever tell you specifically what it was about Gaudí that spoke to him?
Only what Winston mentioned, she replied. His architecture feels as if it were created by nature herself. Gaudí's grottos seem carved by the wind and rain. His supporting pillars seem to have grown out of the earth, and his tile work resembles primitive sea life.
She shrugged.
Whatever the reason, Edmund admired Gaudí enough to move to Spain.
Langdon glanced over at her, surprised. He knew Edmund owned houses in several countries around the world, but in recent years he'd chosen to settle in Spain. You're saying Edmund moved here because of the art of Gaudí?
I believe he did, Umbra said. I once asked him, why Spain? And he told me he had the rare opportunity to rent a unique property here, a property unlike anything else in the world. I assume he meant his apartment, she said.
Where's his apartment?
Robert, Edmund lived in Casa Milà.
Langdon did a double take. The Casa Milà?
The one and only, she replied with a nod. Last year he rented the entire top floor as his penthouse apartment.
Langdon needed a moment to process the news. Casa Milà was one of Gaudí's most famous buildings, a dazzlingly original house whose tiered facade and undulating stone balconies resembled an excavated mountain, sparking its now popular nickname, La Pedrera, meaning the stone quarry. Isn't the top floor a Gaudí museum? Langdon asked, recalling one of his visits to the building in the past.
Yes, Winston offered. But Edmund made a donation to UNESCO, which protects the house as a World Heritage Site, and they agreed to temporarily close it down and let him live there for 2 years. After all, there's no shortage of Gaudí art in Barcelona.
Edmund lived inside a Gaudí exhibit at Casa Milà? Langdon puzzled. And he moved in for only 2 years? Winston chimed in. Edmund even helped Casa Milà create a new educational video about its architecture. It's worth seeing.
The video is actually quite impressive, Umbra agreed, leaning forward and touching the browser screen.
A keyboard appeared and she typed lapedrera.com.
You should watch this.
I'm kind of driving, Langdon replied. Umbra reached over to the steering column and gave two quick pulls on a small lever. Langdon could feel the steering wheel suddenly stiffen in his hands, and immediately noticed that the car appeared to be guiding itself, remaining perfectly centered in its lane.
Autopilot, she said.
The effect was quite unsettling, and Langdon could not help but leave his hands hovering over the wheel and his foot over the brake.
Relax.
Umbra reached over and placed a comforting hand on his shoulder.
It's far safer than a human driver.
Reluctantly, Langdon lowered his hands to his lap.
There you go, she smiled. Now you can watch this Casa Milà video.
The video began with a dramatic low shot of pounding surf, as if taken from a helicopter flying only a few feet above the open ocean. Rising in the distance was an island, a stone mountain with sheer cliffs that climbed hundreds of feet above the crashing waves. Text materialized over the mountain. La Pedrera wasn't created by Gaudí. For the next 30 seconds, Langdon watched as the surf began carving the mountain into the distinctive organic-looking exterior of Casamila. Next, the ocean rushed inside, creating hollows and cavernous rooms in which waterfalls carved staircases and vines grew, twisting into iron banisters as mosses grew beneath them, carpeting the floors. Finally, the camera pulled back out to sea and revealed the famous image of Casamila, the quarry, carved into a massive mountain. La Pedrera, a masterpiece of nature. Langdon had to admit Edmund had a knack for drama. Seeing this computer-generated video made him eager to revisit the famous building. Returning his eyes to the road, Langdon reached down and disengaged the autopilot, taking back control. Let's just hope Edmund's apartment contains what we're looking for. We need to find that password. Chapter 50. Commander Diego Garza led his four armed Guardia agents directly across the center of Plaza de la Armería, keeping his eyes straight ahead and ignoring the clamoring media outside the fence, all of whom were aiming television cameras at him through the bars and shouting for a comment. At least they'll see that someone is taking action. When he and his team arrived at the cathedral, the main entrance was locked, not surprising at this hour, and Garza began pounding on the door with the handle of his sidearm. No answer. He kept pounding. Finally, the locks turned and the door swung open. Garza found himself face to face with a cleaning woman who looked understandably alarmed by the small army outside the door. "Where is Bishop Valdespino?" Garza demanded.
I don't know," the woman replied.
"I know the bishop is here," Garza declared, "and he is with Prince Julian. You haven't seen them?"
She shook her head.
"I just arrived. I clean on Saturday nights after—"
Garza pushed past her, directing his men to spread out through the darkened cathedral.
"Lock the door," Garza told the cleaning woman, "and stay out of the way."
With that, he cocked his weapon and headed directly for Valdespino's office. Across the plaza, in the palace's basement control room, Monica Martin was standing at the water cooler and taking a pull on a long-overdue cigarette. Thanks to the liberal, politically correct movement sweeping Spain, smoking in palace offices had been banned. But with the deluge of alleged crimes being pinned on the palace tonight, Martin figured a bit of second-hand smoke was a tolerable infraction. All five news stations on the bank of muted televisions lined up before her continued their live coverage of the assassination of Edmund Kirsch, flagrantly replaying the footage of his brutal murder over and over. Of course, each retransmission was preceded by the usual warning. Caution. The following clip contains graphic images that may not be appropriate for all viewers.
Shameless, she thought,
knowing these warnings were not sensitive network precautions, but rather clever teasers to ensure that nobody changed the channel. Martine took another pull on her cigarette, scanning the various networks, most of which were milking the growing conspiracy theories with breaking news headlines and ticker tape crawls. Futurist killed by church? Scientific discovery lost forever? Assassin hired by royal family? You're supposed to report the news, she grumbled, not spread vicious rumors in the form of questions. Martine had always believed in the importance of responsible journalism as a cornerstone of freedom and democracy, and so she was routinely disappointed by journalists who incited controversy by broadcasting ideas that were patently absurd, all the while avoiding legal repercussions by simply turning every ludicrous statement into a leading question. Even respected science channels were doing it, asking their viewers, "Is it possible that this temple in Peru was built by ancient aliens?"
No, Martine wanted to shout at the television. It's not freaking possible. Stop asking moronic questions. On one of the television screens, she could see that CNN seemed to be doing its best to be respectful. Remembering Edmund Kirsch, prophet, visionary, creator. Martine picked up the remote and turned up the volume. A man who loved art, technology, and innovation, said the news anchor sadly. A man whose almost mystical ability to predict the future made him a household name. According to his colleagues, every single prediction made by Edmund Kirsch in the field of computer science has become a reality.
That's right, David, interjected his female co-host. I just wish we could say the same for his personal predictions.
They now played archival footage of a robust, tanned Edmund Kirsch giving a press conference on the sidewalk outside 30 Rockefeller Center in New York City.
Today I'm 30 years old, Edmund said, and my life expectancy is only 68. However, with future advances in medicine, longevity technology, and telomere regeneration, I predict I will live to see my 110th birthday. In fact, I'm so confident of this fact that I just reserved the Rainbow Room for my 110th birthday party.
Kirsch smiled and gazed up to the top of the building.
I just now paid my entire bill 80 years in advance, including provisions for inflation.
The female anchor returned, sighing somberly. As the old adage goes, men plan, and God laughs.
So true, the male host chimed. And on top of the intrigue surrounding Kirsch's death, there is also an explosion of speculation over the nature of his discovery. He stared earnestly at the camera. Where do we come from? Where are we going? Two fascinating questions.
And to answer these questions, the female host added excitedly, we are joined by two very accomplished women, an Episcopal minister from Vermont and an evolutionary biologist from UCLA. We'll be back after the break with their thoughts.
Martine already knew their thoughts. Polar opposites, or they would not be on your show. No doubt the minister would say something like, we come from God and we're going to God. And the biologist would respond, we evolved from apes and we're going extinct. They will prove nothing except that we viewers will watch anything if it's sufficiently hyped.
Monica, Suresh shouted nearby.
Martine turned to see the director of electronic security rounding the corner, practically at a jog.
What is it?
She asked.
Bishop Valdespino just called me, he said breathlessly.
She muted the TV. The bishop called you? Did he tell you what the hell he's doing?
Suresh shook his head. I didn't ask, and he didn't offer. He was calling to see if I could check something on our phone servers.
I don't understand.
You know how ConspiracyNet is now reporting that someone inside this palace placed a call to the Guggenheim shortly before tonight's event? A request for Ambra Vidal to add Avila's name to the guest list?
Yes, and I asked you to look into it.
Well, Valdespino seconded your request. He called to ask if I would log into the palace's switchboard and find the record of that call to see if I could figure out where in the palace it had originated, in hopes of getting a better idea of who here might have placed it.
Martine felt confused, having imagined that Valdespino himself was the most likely suspect.
According to the Guggenheim, Suresh continued, their front desk received a call from Madrid Royal Palace's primary number tonight, shortly before the event. It's in their phone logs. But here's the problem. I looked into our switchboard logs to check our outbound calls with the same timestamp.
He shook his head.
Nothing. Not a single call. Someone deleted the record of the palace's call to the Guggenheim.
Martine studied her colleague a long moment.
Who has access to do that?
That's exactly what Valdespino asked me. And so I told him the truth. I told him that I, as head of electronic security, could have deleted the record, but that I had not done so, and that the only other person with clearance and access to those records is Commander Garza. Martine stared.